historically it seems that I haven't been in the best. No.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WMFO 91.5 FM Tufts Freeform Radio. Coming up in just a second, we're going to have a full hour of Tufts sports and general sports talk with JumboCast Radio. But we're going to open it up with a sort of baseball-ish theme song. This is Clamp Down, live from Shea Stadium, The Clash. Clamp Down live from Shea Stadium. That's a Clash live album from way back in the day. Again, you're listening to JumboCast Radio. I'm Charlie. I'm going to be hosting this afternoon. We're joined right now currently by three other members of the JumboCast team. We're going to have some more people coming up soon. You guys want to go around and introduce yourself?
Sure, I'll get started. My name is Lucas Johnson. I'm a junior here in JumboCast. Been doing JumboCast for 3 years now. Mostly a play-by-play guy, so.
I'm Noah Goldstein. I'm a freshman here, so it's my first year in JumboCast.
I'm Jared Davis. I'm a sophomore. Been in JumboCast on and off a little bit. You'll see me commentating, and I'll be on the sideline, like last Friday, actually.
Yeah, that was last Friday's game against Amherst when we pulled out all the stops in an ultimate Tufts loss. Sort of a bad Tufts loss, not necessarily the performance that Carla Berube would have wanted from her team there. So we're going to have a live interview coming up later in the show. We have two swimmers from the Tufts swimming and diving team coming up. That's the team that won the NESCACs last year. We'll talk about their current season, what it's like to be a student-athlete at Tufts and all that as soon as they come up and into the studio. But we're going to start, I guess, with a little pro sports talk was what we were feeling like. Lucas, you wanted to talk about the basketball trade deadline?
Yeah, it ended up being a pretty busy trade deadline after a lot of people thought not a lot of stuff was going to go down. Obviously, the biggest name, Anthony Davis, didn't get moved, but we still did see a good amount of moves throughout the league that should solidify some teams' positioning, specifically in the Eastern Conference. When you look at what the Bucks did, adding a good stretch four in Nikola Mirotic, he should really help them kind of try and lock down that one seed. And then to try and counter that, Toronto, of course, adding Marc Gasol to their roster, so that'll be an interesting dynamic there. Especially with Serge Ibaka already kind of cementing himself as their starting center. Kind of interesting to see some trades that didn't go down. Obviously, like we mentioned, the Anthony Davis trade didn't happen, so that's a win for Boston, I suppose, even though, of course, Anthony Davis's father saying he doesn't want his son playing for the Celtics after how they treated Isaiah Thomas.
I love basketball dads.
Yeah, you gotta love the Anthony Davis father, you know, pairing with the with LeVar Ball's comments earlier, especially regarding that potential trade with the Lakers, LeVar Ball saying he doesn't want his son playing for New Orleans. He'd want him to go to Phoenix, as if Lonzo Ball deserves a say.
Have you seen the photos that have come out recently of a lot of sort of college football commits and how they're taking photos in uniform with their parents who are also in uniform? So it's just all overweight middle-aged men sort of in tight-fitting football jerseys. I think that basketball and the NBA should start doing that.
Saw LeVar yesterday morning on Fox Sports. He declared Lonzo was a better player right now than LeBron.
I'm excited for LeVar to take over for Stephen A. Smith on First Take.
Yeah, I mean, I think LeVar thinks that he should be the coach over Luke Walton right now. He was saying some pretty ridiculous things. I think that LeBron had sort of a hold over LeVar for a while and was keeping him quiet. Then when LeVar found out that LeBron was trying to get Lonzo traded, all that kind of went out the window. He's back to his old self.
Have any of you watched the Ball family like reality show?
I watched a little bit when it came out.
What was it like?
Kind of interesting, I can't lie. Especially, they did kind of focus on LeVar Ball. I guess you kind of have to, but...
Well, he's also, you know, I guess producing the show.
Exactly, so a little bit of bias there, but... There was a nice spotlight on Lonzo Ball, which I thought was interesting because at least what I get from Lonzo is he seems like more of a quiet personality. You know, his father's the completely outspoken type, but Lonzo just kind of gives off a chill vibe to me. So it was actually kind of interesting to see this, you know, reality TV show of a up-and-coming NBA player who you wouldn't necessarily hear a lot from. And it was well-produced and everything. Obviously, it went through some drama with, you know, Lonzo and whether he's, you know, really in love with his girlfriend and all that. But so at the end of the day, it was a reality TV show.
What was the verdict on that? Are they still together?
No. Well, I stopped watching, but I guess, no, they broke up. And I guess, doesn't Lonzo have a son now?
Does he?
Wasn't that
yes,
the drama?
Didn't, he does, yeah.
What's the son's name? Does it also start with an L?
I don't think that he's in the son's life. I think there's something going on with the girlfriend there.
Interesting.
Yeah, the whole TV show was... Reality TV was a very general term. You could tell the LeVar effect on the show. It was
Reality TV, most of reality TV is fake. There's the reality TV that's documentaries. I've recently been watching a lot of Sunderland Till I Die on Netflix, which is like the Netflix reality show that follows Sunderland for an entire year and is the biggest dramatic irony of all time because everyone's filled with hope and then they get relegated from the championship. But then there's reality TV like, you know, The Bachelor.
Yeah.
I was in a Bachelorette fantasy football or fantasy league for a while.
How'd that go?
So you make guesses. They give you questions because it's ESPN runs it and it's ABC who controls the rights to The Bachelorette and Bachelor. And so you like make guesses about what's going to happen on the show, and because ridiculous things happen, it's like, who, like, which of the bachelorettes, like, trips and falls on so
it's
the, like on the river, in the rose
it's
ceremony.
Like prop
bets. Yeah, so it's a lot of prop bets, and then you actually get to pick who is going to, like, receive the roses, and you start at the beginning and you pick from the entire like group of bachelors. You pick exactly who you think gets out where. Like, you get your final four. You pick your final rose.
That's incredible.
And there's some sort of point system. I think I came in third place in the end.
So you know your stuff.
Yeah, but there was also the thing where I was like, oh, I'm in this Bachelorette Fantasy League. I should probably start watching The Bachelorette. And I watched one episode, and I could not make it through. Did you know they're all 2 hours long? Like, every single one of those episodes is 2 hours long?
No, I've never been into them. I can easily see them dragging that along.
It's too long. At a certain point, like, you want, like, I guess 40 minutes of bad television is fine, right? Mm-hmm. But once you pass 40 minutes of bad television, and then you're like, oh, well, this bad television has been going on for 2 hours, you don't really need that. We're gonna take a short break here with another Live at Shea album, because that's the theme I'm going for our interstitial music here. We're gonna listen to... let's see, what am I feeling like? We're going to do Everybody Loves You Now. This is Billy Joel, live at Shea.
Everybody loves you now. Baby, all the lights are turned on.
That was Billy Joel live at Shea Stadium. Everybody Loves You Now. And we're joined by two new people on mic. Trevor, you want to introduce yourself and your guest?
All right. I'm Trevor Russo. I'm the technical director of JumboCast. And with me, I brought my former hallmate. And oh, wow, the mic just fell out.
Yeah, you're good.
Yeah, we're good. And current Tufts Jumbo swimmer, John Lalim. So...
Hey,
welcome,
there.
John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Trevor.
Oh, no problem. We're just going to do deal with this issue. Okay, we're back here. So, I guess, John, you've been swimming for a couple years now. How'd your, I guess, swimming career start?
It started, oh gosh, I'm 20 now, so it started 15 years ago. I tried a whole bunch of other sports, starting with baseball, because my dad really wanted me to play baseball. It ended with me leaving the outfield and trying to scale the fence out of the park, and the coach having to come up and peel me off. My parents said, you have to finish the season, but after that you can pick a different sport. And for some reason I said swimming, and 15 years later, here I am.
And I guess, what motivated you to come to Tufts for swimming? Because I know you were kind of recruited, right?
Yeah, I was recruited. I really felt like I connected with Coach Hoyt, who was recruiting me, and the rest of the swimmers on the team. And I felt like the values that Tufts had fit in with the values that I had. And that's what I think ultimately attracted me to the school.
Had you always been looking to swim at college?
Yeah, I think so. I was being recruited by a few different schools, and it kind of came down to I was blessed enough to be able to make the choice, and I chose Tufts.
And then, so we're in season right now. What's your sort of daily routine like? How do practices work, meets?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a two-hour practice every day, every member of the team. That usually starts in the morning, 8:15 to 10:15, so we have time to make it to the 10:30 class. And then usually at night, two or three times a week, we have an extra hour-long practice where we get back in the water and do some fast swimming, usually pacing-related, doing times related to the races. And then we also have team lifts throughout the season, throughout the week. And it amounts to about 15 hours a week of total training time.
And then that's on top of that, then you have competitions on the weekends?
Yes, and then after that, we have competitions on the weekends, usually one per weekend, so though sometimes we have two. Usually around, local is normal, but we sometimes have a long bus ride.
So. Yeah, so I guess also one of the remarkable things about the stuff you've done at Tufts is you actually have two of the jumbo records right now, the 100 and 1650 free.
The 1,000.
The 1,000. That's what I was, I forgot to add the zero.
Yeah, one more zero, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, what was that like, essentially, knowing that, you know, now your name is in jumbo history for until someone breaks it, I guess?
Yeah. No, it was cool. It was, I hadn't really thought about it last year when it happened, because I was just trying to make my teammates proud at our conference meet last year. You know, and with swimming, I think people oftentimes think it's very individualized, but you know, you just, in that situation, when you're at a conference meet and you're trying to score as many points for your team as possible, it's just, you know, you don't think about your individual performances. You just try and go out and make everybody proud. And then, you know, even after I finished the race, and it took people coming up to me and telling me that I had done that for me to even notice. So it was just a really cool experience last year at NESCAX, and hopefully we can do the same this year.
And so how is your season going so far?
We're doing well this year. Last year, we won our first conference title in history, and we finished seventh in Division III at the national meet, which was our best finish in years. So coming off of that, I think it's always hard to readjust and, you know, get, you know, essentially replace a fourth of your team with freshmen. And so, you know, every team is different, and every year is different. We face different challenges. We've had different successes. But I really feel like things are coming together now that are going to set us up really well to compete at the conference meet and then go on to the national meet and compete there as well.
Mm-hmm. And you have the NESCAC Championships coming up, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so do you switch your mindset for sort of postseason swimming or the championship stuff?
Yeah, you definitely do, because in season you're usually swimming tired, you're usually swimming beat up. You know, we'll have like a 8,000 yard day, and then the next day be expected to get in the pool and race MIT or Boston College, and you know, they might not be in the same place that we are in terms of training, and it just becomes hard to to race against guys and women that you don't really know exactly where they're at or where they've been with their training. But, you know, in the postseason, it's everybody's rested, everybody's shaved, everybody's tapered, everybody's fired up and ready to go. So it just becomes, you know, much more of a battle with the other teams. Whereas in season, it's really just, you know, go out and do what you can. Now it's very much the playing field is leveled, and now it's just who has the best team.
Yeah, and I guess a sort of follow-up question to that is in-season is kind of weird in the way that it falls on either side of winter break. How do you negotiate winter break, and do you have to come back early to compete or stay late to compete?
Yeah, so we don't come back, or we don't leave early, but we do come back a few days early, and having the season split up is definitely a big challenge. But how it works is that, you know, as finals start, you know, our official practices stop. And so everybody's on their own for essentially a month to train through finals and reading period and then over winter break. And it's up to every member of the team to get in the pool or get in the weight room and do whatever it is that they need to do to stay in shape. And then right after New Year's, we all get together for our training trip that lasts 13, 14 days. And then it's really intense, really hard, really fast swimming for that amount of time. And, you know, it's two practices a day with dry land sessions in between. And we come back a few days early, we have one or two swim meets, and then it's, you know, almost time to start thinking about getting ready for NESCAC. So it creates a challenge, but it also gives us an opportunity to focus on our training in a real way that you can't do when you're taking exams or mm-hmm. or studying for classes.
Yeah, and how do you sort of reconcile, I guess the early part of midterm season is coming up as your postseason comes up.
Right.
How do you negotiate having all of these practices, 15 hours a week of practices plus weekend competitions, with actually having homework to do and classes and things like that?
It's definitely a challenge, but you have to know you have to know what's going on. You have to know your schedule. You have to know what assignments you have. And then you have to be able to know when it's swimming time, when it's school time, when it's friend time, when it's, you know, sleeping time. I mean, you just have to be able to understand what you're doing and when you're on a team, what everybody else is doing. But it gets hard, and there's definitely challenges. But, I mean, you just have to remember why you are doing what you're doing, and because you love this sport and because you want to be there for your teammates and make everybody proud at the end of the year.
I guess, you know, going off of that, once, you know, the whole grind is done, once you guys finish NESCAC's NCAA tournament, what is your life like, essentially, once all that's over?
Yeah, so it's a little bit more relaxed. I think most members of the team take some time off to kind of reflect on the season and get caught up in schoolwork that is inevitably missed, you know, during conference time and national time. But then it's right back to it. Swimming is not a sport where you can take off between seasons. You know, if I had done that, I wouldn't be where I am now. We really have to keep training. So right after that, we start offering not official practices, but times to get back in the water. And, you know, a good chunk of our team takes that. And then over the summer, people are in the water training, and then preseason people are training. So it's really a year-round sport, and you have to think about it like that, you know, to be successful.
Definitely, definitely. With all that time in the water, do you ever get sick of being in the pool?
Yeah, I mean, it gets repetitive sometimes. But I think that's why being with a great group of men and women is so important. And that's, you know, part of the reason why I chose to come to Tufts, is because when you're surrounded by, you know, 80 of your favorite people in the world, it doesn't get repetitive, because at each practice you're surrounded by different people and you're experiencing different, you know, different sets and different personalities. And our coaches are great at keeping things pretty lively and spirited. And really the time does go by pretty quick. And, you know, it is just moving. And I always say it's just moving from one side of the pool to the other, essentially. But, I mean, when you're doing it with just the greatest people that you can imagine, it just makes it so much easier.
That's fantastic. I know you do long distance, and I couldn't imagine swimming a mile in the pool. What is your mindset during that race?
Yeah, so the mile's 66 length, so 1, 2, 3, back and forth. It takes about you know, 16 minutes to do, which is a long time to be by yourself and with those thoughts. You know, I think more than any other kind of swimming, it's just about mental toughness and knowing, you know, who you are and what you've done. And you really just have to, you have to be determined. You have to, you know, have nerves of steel. You have to be able to make in-race adjustments. You have to be able to, you know, to just believe in yourself and to not focus on the other swimmers in the pool that might be doing, you know, different things. I always say it's like a chess match, that like they might make a move when you're not so ready to make a move, and then you're kind of a little bit behind, or you make a move and pull ahead of them, and now they're starting to catch up to you. So, you know, you just have to, for me, I just like to think about all the people that I'm trying to make proud and all the people who have, you know, given up so much for me to have the opportunity to do what I'm doing. And, you know, I think with that mindset and the mindset that, you know, I believe in myself, these people believe in me, you know, and if you remove failure from being an option, you really can't go wrong.
And so then when you're in race, how much of it is sort of you just versus yourself and trying to swim the best race you can and actually sort of swimming against these other people and considering what they're doing?
Yeah, I think that's different for every athlete or every swimmer in the water. For me, I like to race, and I do like to compete. I think it's healthy. And I think, you know, with Tufts, we get to swim against some of the best swimmers in Division III in the country, just in our conference. So, you know, I think racing's a good idea, but specifically with my kind of swimming, the long distance swimming, you have to be okay with being with yourself. You have to be okay with just taking the time to think about what you're doing and separating it from everybody else. Because, you know, when you're doing 66 laps of the pool, I mean, if someone is going, you know, 0.5 seconds faster than you on every single lap, they're going to end up 30 seconds faster than you. So those little tiny differences add up. And so it can seem like the race is really getting away from you, where in reality, if you think about it, you know, for each 25, you're really only 0.2 behind them, but it looks like they're just killing you. So you have to be able to understand that and use those understandings to your advantage, but it's definitely a mix of both, of being okay with who you are and where you are and what you're doing, and using the other people in the pool who have trained just as hard as you have to understand where you're going.
Were there any unexpected changes jumping from a high school swimming program into a college D3 environment?
Yeah, I mean, the intensity definitely goes up, and you know, from a lot of in swimming, you know, your club swimming that you do before you get to college, it's high yardage stuff. You know, it would not be unusual for me to do 12,000 yards a day of swimming in high school. And coming to Tufts, you know, I do much less than that. And, you know, adjusting to that is definitely hard, but that's how college swimming is. You don't do as much, but what you do better. And that's the kind of mindset that you have to take with it. But yeah, I mean, the intensity goes up, and the level of I guess the team goes up. You stop swimming for yourself and you start swimming for the team. And I think that is probably the coolest part of coming into, I think, specifically a D3 program. Because I mean, if you're talking about D1, a lot of those swimmers are essentially getting paid to go to these schools. They're getting big incentives. But at D3, you just have 40 men and 40 women on a team who just really love the sport and love each other, and that's why they're doing it. And I think that's the coolest thing that you can have in a group of people.
I mean, I guess one question is, for me, I've always wondered, why did you choose long distance over, you know, maybe something more manageable and reasonable?
Well, you know, I don't know. That's a good question. I guess one of the things is that it's hard. You know, I'm not the biggest person in the world. I'm pretty short, especially for a sport where, you know, you're almost every swimmer you can probably name is just a giant. And if you look at our team, filled with giants. So long distance swimming is more so using your mind and being mentally tough. And so I think I just kind of gravitated towards that. And that's not to say that, you know, a short person can't sprint or a short person can't do anything. I think that anybody can do anything when they put their mind to it. And that's why, you know, I chose that form of swimming, is because in that form of swimming where you just have to put your body in a situation where it's just biologically not supposed to go. I mean, you're not supposed to swim that long at that intensity. You know, when you get into that level of mental challenge, it doesn't matter how tall you are. I mean, what you look like, where you come from, who you love, none of that matters. It's just, you know, do you have the capacity to put yourself on the line? And with that kind of swimming, I mean, that's just what it comes down to, the training, the racing. And I just kind of gravitated towards that.
All right. I think that's a good note to end on. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Great. Thanks.
All right. We're going to play another song. This one's from REM's Automatic for the People, sort of swimming themed. It's called Night Swimming. And we're back. Tufts Swimming and Diving actually has a meet tonight at BU and tomorrow as well. So if anyone's interested in that, that is something that exists. Right now, though, I have a PSA. Although other physical activities can provide a more vigorous workout, walking is easy, requires no special equipment, and is good exercise for most adults. In urban areas, walking can be an excellent alternative to driving or even taking public transportation. For example, it's just a little over 2.5 miles from the Tufts campus in Medford to Harvard Square in Cambridge, a distance that can be walked in about 45 minutes by a healthy adult. Walking can get you fresh air, exercise, burn calories, save you money, and with all the inattentive and otherwise impaired drivers on the road, it's safer than riding a bike. A public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Community Radio. And so now we're going to plow into the part of our show where we're going to discuss Tufts women's basketball, who suffered a hard fought 10-point loss, 50-40 against Amherst last Friday. Trevor, you want to tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, the thing is, for months, basically, or at least however long the schedule's been out, we at JumboCast have circled two games on our schedule as, you know, as is every year. The top three teams in, you know, the NESCAC are always Bowdoin, Amherst, and Tufts. They lost earlier at Bowdoin. They sort of got blown out in the fourth quarter in February, or not February, January over winter break. But there was a chance really for the Jumbos to rebound from that and take the number two seed, which I don't think they have done in a while, against this Amherst team that was coming to their court. Jumbos, you know, all the way up to number four in D3, Amherst at number five. Amherst had actually suffered two defeats this year, which is unprecedented.
Yeah, they've lost to Eastern Connecticut State, as well as to the number one ranked Bowdoin team, who look locked up as the top seed in the NESCAC and most likely got to be the overwhelming favorites to win that competition.
And D3 maybe too at this point. But
Tufts Amherst, also good to note, is that that's a rematch of the last two NCAA championship games. Tufts lost both of those to Amherst by fairly lopsided scorelines.
Yeah. So the, you know, Jumbos, they came in with only one loss on the season, and they left with two. And the surprising thing that I saw was that they were never really in the game at any point, the Jumbos. Right from the get-go, Amherst was never blowing them out per se, but there was always a healthy, you know, 5-10 point lead, and it seemed like more than any other time the Jumbos were having trouble scoring. Because usually you can't stop what they do in the paint, but Amherst, of course, a fantastic defensive team, and the Jumbos' shooting woes were on full display.
Yeah, and I think you have to point to the way that Amherst was setting up in their extremely tight man defense.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. They took DeCandido out of the game, which was big, and she sets the presence down low, and once you take her out of the game, it really changed the dynamic of the Tufts offense.
Yeah, it was sort of a situation where every time that the Jumbos tried to play into the paint, there were two mammoths there, and if they tried to play to the perimeter, it was still, anyone was fully guarded. There was just no opportunity for open shots, and they weren't really trying to take any 50-50 chances.
Yeah.
Yeah, and well, Tufts was playing good defense, too. I mean, you mentioned Amherst is a great defensive team. Bottom line is, Amherst actually had more turnovers than Tufts. Tufts only had 12, Amherst had 17. But as Trevor, you just mentioned, Tufts just had a terrible night shooting the basketball. They were 12 of 55 total. Emily Briggs and DeCandido combined 2 of 21 from the floor. As a team, they shot 21.8%, whereas Amherst, they only had 41 field goal attempts all night, so Tufts did a good job limiting them, but Amherst was just much more efficient, shooting it at a 43.9% clip.
This might sound sarcastic, but I'm genuinely curious. Did Tufts make a three?
Tufts made two threes, yep. They were 2 of 12 from deep.
Yeah.
Amherst only made three in addition. Yeah, Amherst only made three. Mm-hmm.
Started
yeah.
opening up a little bit towards the end of the game. We started getting our shooting touch, but our guards, Jack Knapp and Molly Ryan, just didn't rise to the occasion on Friday night.
Mm-hmm. It was also a situation, I think, where Jumbos were pretty quick to foul. There was a lot of free throws, and the Jumbos, Lucas, do you have the free throw percentage for the Jumbos? Because they were something, if I remember correctly, like 50% from the line compared to Amherst.
No, Jumbos shot it pretty well, actually. They were 14 of 17, yeah.
Oh, I felt like there were more misses. I guess there were misses in clutch situations. Mm. But Amherst, what was Amherst's stat on that?
11 of 13 from the lineup.
Oh, I guess I completely misread that.
It seemed a different way.
Yeah, I mean, part of that, I think, was you point to the officiating was questionable. I think we leaned into that a lot on our broadcast. But there were some bizarre calls that were made against the Jumbos, usually on one side of the court.
Especially early on, that was a big thing. Kind of set the tempo, the mood of the game, was that things kind of weren't going the Jumbos' way early.
There were some inconsistent travel calls. There were some calls that I don't think any of us knew exactly what the foul was. And that also had an effect of demoralizing the Jumbos a bit.
So much of what the Jumbos do is based on putting pressure on teams on the defensive end and running in transition after turnovers and scoring off of turnovers. So if they're unable to apply that pressure and really get to the guards of the opposing team, they have a tough time scoring in the half court. They do rely on De Candido a bunch, as you all mentioned. She does a great job of passing out of the post, but if the opposition really keys in on her and does not allow open looks on the three-point line, the Jumbos are going to have a tough time scoring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we mentioned those shooting woes of the Jumbos. I mean, honestly, I don't think the Jumbos even played that poorly. Like, the stats tell a very poor picture.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you can hold Amherst, which has two people averaging like 18 points a game, to 50 points in a game, you think you should win it.
Exactly. I mean, these poor shooting numbers, it's not like they're missing wide open shots. These were completely 100% contested shots. They were very difficult.
Yeah, there were some that you think they perhaps should have made, and the game could have definitely gone a different way as a result, but it was more of a hard luck loss. And I think the drop in the rankings from 4 to 8 reflected
that.
Or 4 to 6.
Yeah,
4 to 6 sort of reflected the fact that that was more a case of being unlucky than being just completely destroyed by an Amherst team.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, there wasn't, I mean, I think it just happened to the fact that, you know, the fouls and then Amherst, when it mattered, were making their shots. Amherst, I think they did, when the ball, I don't know, when, it's going to sound weird, but I guess when the ball kind of went up for Amherst, sometimes you knew basically 60 to 75% of the time when they got a shot off, semi-contested, it was going to go in. Whereas the Jumbos, I mean, I made a prediction before winter break that this team was going to be better than the one from last year due to the improved shooting, and but so far coming out of that show, the shooting numbers for across the board have kind of dipped off, really. And the only one who's making threes consistently is Lily Paro, who only comes in blowout situations.
Yeah, and she came in a blowout situation actually the day after in the game against Hamilton.
She had a big performance. I think finished with 22 points off of the bench. You got to think that maybe they get her some more minutes. She does not factor in. You know, there's a lot of movement on that Jumbo's offense. When Lily Paro's in, she's moving around the three-point line looking for a shot. And when she gets it, she's very efficient with those looks. Maybe she plays some more minutes for the Jumbos down the stretch.
Yeah, she played 17 minutes in that game against Hamilton. That's a game that the Jumbos ended up winning 79-44. And from that, she shot 8 from 11 of the field. And of that, 6 of 8 from 3, scoring 22 points. And 22 points in 17 minutes is a very good performance. And that's in a... She was sort of stealing minutes from Harrington and Briggs, two of the guards.
So, I mean, yeah, I guess the question is, because Trinity is a... It's not, you know, it's not one of the better NESCAC teams, but it is one of the better in a sense.
Yeah, I don't think you can say it's a gimme game.
They're 18-4, 5-3 in conference. They're a good team. So the question is, against... You know, Hamilton has not won a conference game all year, but against maybe Trinity, one of those mid-high-tier NESCAC teams, maybe Lily Paro factors a little bit more so they can get her some run. For the
yeah,
NESCAC
I think
tournament.
Part of it, though, is that they're... I don't think they're going to be the most difficult team to defend. They're averaging only 63 points per game. Jumbos are averaging 67, and their points against average is much, much higher than the Jumbos, who have 53.2. Compared to 63.3. So you look at it and you think it's a Sunday. This Sunday afternoon is a game that the Jumbos really should win, and that'll get them into the position I think we expected after the Amherst game, of barring one upset loss from Amherst over their next two games, a position in the NESCAC Championships as a three seed, which really, two seed, three seed is negligible other than the fact that someone's going to play at home.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think they'd be in line to play Middlebury if the seeds stay.
Yeah, I believe
right?
it's out of eight, correct?
Yeah.
So, if it's out of eight, then you're gonna see them start against Middlebury, and that's a team that's 17-5 on the year, 4-4 in conference. Tufts played Middlebury on January 12th, 74-58 win. Mm-hmm. And that was away as well, and they'd get to play Middlebury at home. That was a game in which Jack Knapp scored 22 points. So a good performance from her, but really you expect the whole narrative of the NESCAC as we go into that is just, when are we going to have a showdown between the top three teams?
Yeah, that would looking a little bit ahead, that would set us up to see Amherst in the semifinals.
Yeah, and that's how it usually goes. Tufts always manages to play Amherst at least twice in a season, and they're still gunning for their first victory over Amherst since 2016 in a game that they won 51-50 that January. But any sort of win over Amherst, and you would think that this would prime this team for a nice run, at least against Bowdoin, and into the tournament when they're almost guaranteed to get a nice at-large bid, maybe with first-round hosting duties.
Yeah, hopefully. And maybe we'd get those games on JumboCast, be able to watch them.
Yeah, fingers crossed we'll get the first round of that in the event. And I think we should get a first game of the NESCAC Championships if they're played at Cousins Gymnasium, which you would expect it would be.
Yeah.
That is traditionally how it goes. So I think that's all the words we have for women's basketball. Men's basketball, their seasons is more or less over. They're going to have a chance to sort of run in the NESCAC, but they're coming in around 500, and even playing better as of late won't be enough to get them into the tournament, barring a nice Cinderella run.
Yeah, that upset of Wesleyan was pretty crazy, though.
Yeah, that was probably the biggest result of the season. Wesleyan was a nationally ranked team, and they just fully outplayed them, racing out to a big, I think, 16-point lead at halftime. They proceeded to blow that 16-point lead, but they actually held on for the win and really looked the better team against Wesleyan in a victory 75-71. And they also just played LaSalle on Thursday, and they broke 100, 101-90 win against LaSalle. I think they're the Lasers, LaSalle Lasers. Fun college
really?
Mascot. Yeah.
You wouldn't think that. I mean, college mascots.
Yeah, it was unexpected. No, I saw LaSalle play a game, actually. I saw some LaSalle women's soccer this season, and they had a nice team. But yeah, it was their mascot's the Lasers, which is kind of cool. It's exciting. Not as good as Jumbos, obviously, but so if we're looking at the men, they're 11-12 on the year. That's sort of expected. They have one senior who is a walk-on, Brian Crianti, hasn't really gotten minutes. And then you have, I think, one or two juniors on that team. This is a team almost entirely made up of underclassmen. They're sort of learning the lay of the land. They've had these nice victories. They've had moments when they've had mental lapses and lost games. And so coming out about 500, I think, primes you for future success rather than necessarily as sort of a failure given the Jumbo's long hallmark of success.
Yeah.
And let's then jump out of the NESCAC and out of Tufts sports for a bit, and let's talk about the Super Bowl. What's our breakdown of Patriots fans in the room?
I'm an Eagles fan, but I was rooting for the Patriots, which
okay,
I
so
can explain later.
I think you were the only one there.
Same here.
Oh, okay, you were too?
From Los Angeles, so
yeah,
bummed
so I think Lucas and I, as New Yorkers, were
extremely, extremely bummed, yeah. But to be expected.
I read a Monday Morning QB piece today that was like predicting the next five Super Bowl champions, and one writer picked the Jets.
There you go.
Yeah, Sam Darnold. Apparently after Adam Gase gets fired, though.
Yeah, there you go, exactly.
Yeah, that's bold.
You know, I think my prediction for that Super Bowl would be Adam Gase eventually uses his eyes as lasers and then just, you know, burns the opposing coach.
One guy was
forfeit.
He's going to be the LaSalle mascot.
There was another writer who said, I think it was Connor Orr. If anyone reads Monday Morning Quarterback, is a great Sports Illustrated NFL blog, some of the best NFL writing around. But he was like, Brady retires after like two or three more seasons, and he is replaced by Bill Belichick playing a 2QB system with Tua Tagovailoa and Brian Hoyer and their co-MVPs.
Are they on the field together?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, listen, I've been saying for years that we should have more 2QB looks in the NFL. Sacrifice a running back? Like, if you get a nice,
bad.
like, if you look at Lamar Jackson can probably throw a block. So you throw Joe Flacco, Lamar Jackson out on the same field for the Ravens.
I don't know about
you play an adjusted wildcat.
How frustrated Drew Brees looked when they took him off the field on third down.
Yeah, that's why you don't take him off the field.
But you don't want Drew Brees.
Yeah, Drew Brees is not going to play running back,
well,
or
I'm
else
not saying,
you're losing
I'm not
your
saying,
40-year-old quarterback forever.
No, but what I'm saying is it adds sort of an unpredictability if you have someone who can also throw.
But you can't have someone standing on one side of the field doing completely nothing.
No, they both line up. You line up in like an I form or like a split back.
Drew Brees
well,
in the I form.
Brees, right. Brees stood out there as a wide receiver. It was the biggest joke. He stood out there and he ran like 3 feet
well, that's
and
not
turned
what,
around.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying you have two quarterbacks, not necessarily under center, but like in the shotgun. Could go to either
you
of them.
Need,
you never
need,
know.
You need to go
on either side. You know, the
is that a legal
like,
formation?
You need like two and Cam Newton back there or something.
Yeah. Well,
you need two big guys.
Yeah.
Or else it's just not respectable.
Listen, we're moving towards a league that's just filled with Taysom Hills, so.
Oh, God. I don't want to live in a world like that.
What is your problem with Taysom Hill?
The fake punt against the Eagles. That still hurts.
Oh, so it's not about his lack of talent.
It's a personal thing.
No, it's not a lack of talent, but like, when you're defending a team that has Taysom Hill back there rather than Drew Brees, you kind of know what's coming. It's either going to be that draw play to Kamara, or he's going to take it out wide to the right. He threw the ball one time.
Well, he almost threw a bomb.
He did.
Well, there was also a game. Yeah, there was a game. The game against the Giants, he threw a touchdown, or he should have thrown a touchdown, and someone dropped it.
Odell also threw two touchdowns this year.
Yeah, well, I mean, Odell's playing quarterback for the Giants.
You
next
see
season.
Jarvis Landry's pass.
That
he had like
good.
A cross field 40-yard pass.
You know, all these wide receivers that are lefties have cannons.
Sanu can throw too.
Yeah,
they're all lefties.
And then Julian Edelman as well.
Yeah,
they're all lefties.
What you don't realize though about having that running quarterback back there really changes the dynamic of the offensive line. They have to be a lot more mobile, smaller players, different type of training now. They're doing a lot more plyometrics, calisthenics, so that they're just flexible. Puts them in risk of more injury. They move it outside the tackle box. It's kind of changing the game a lot, especially that position.
Speaking about that running quarterback, did you guys see Le'Veon Bell having some tweets about Lamar Jackson today?
No. What did he say?
Was it Lamar
Somebody
Jackson?
Somebody tweeted out something. I think it may have been Rappaport saying players want to play with Lamar Jackson, and Le'Veon Bell did one of the winky face type of emojis, which, he's the king of the emojis.
He did the questioning face emoji.
Wait, so they want to play Lamar Jackson against play?
No, he wants to play with Lamar Jackson.
That's
the perfect situation for
Le'Veon Bell. Le'Veon Bell is just, he's stirring the pot on social media. I mean, Jamal Adams of the Jets tweeted like, oh, Le'Veon, it'd be great to have you on the Jets. He'd be like, we have so much fun in New York.
No, honestly, Le'Veon and Jamal Adams on the same team would be hilarious.
That'd be exceptional.
What was your take,
I would love
that. Lucas, what was your take on Jamal Adams tackling Pat Patriot at the Pro Bowl?
Well, obviously, I loved it. I mean, come on. As a Jets fan, there's no way to not love that.
Almost hurt the guy.
That's the thing, though. Yeah, I think what people don't realize is it seems like in the video, the Patriots mascot, like people are like, oh, well, Jamal just blindsided a random civilian in a
suit.
No, the mascot turned around. He was like bracing for it a little bit. And at the end of the day.
No, but also, like, have you ever been tackled by someone who plays football?
Well, that's the other thing. That's the funny thing, too, is Jamal Adams didn't even tackle him hard. But the fact that it's just Jamal Adams is a giant human being.
There was this one time in gym class early in high school, we were playing sort of like this game we had in Briarcliff High School called Speedball, which was like handball plus soccer, sort of hybrid. But so my friend Joey was on the football team, and he was on defense. Like I had the ball, and he was on defense, and he just, for whatever reason, forgot that he was playing speedball and just snapped into football mode and just full-on tackled me onto the gym floor. And it was fairly painful.
Yeah.
So like, when you actually get tackled from a standing position, like, full tilt, that can rattle you. And Jamal Adams is a big man.
Yeah.
Pat the Patriot got his revenge, though. He had a nice hit on Jamal Adams afterwards.
Really?
He did. He got him back.
Yeah, and then he was flagged for roughing the passer.
Yeah, but, so Super Bowl, I guess, you know, defensive game for first time since Super Bowl 50.
You can't vote punters for Super Bowl MVP, and I have never been so mad in my life.
Yeah.
Is that actually
That was
cool?
a very, exce- like, yeah. as a display of punting, every high school football coach should just sit down with his punters and be like, model your game after these two punters.
Yeah, because that was great. Really like, Hecker was just destroying the first half, and every single time Ryan Allen went out and punted, it was perfect.
Johnny Hecker had 9 punts for a total of 417 yards, averaging 46.3.
You know what?
5 of them were in the 20-yard line.
I gotta say, I love punts. They're fun to watch, and there's a lot of different cool things that you can do with them. You ever seen the video where Sam Koch, the punter for the Ravens, basically goes over the 15 different types of punts he uses in a game?
Yeah, you think it's just you're trying to boot it as far as possible, but there it's all about like specific placement, and I can't even imagine. Like, yeah. If I try and punt, like odds are it goes sideways.
Mm-hmm. And just the height too. You got to get a amount of time in the air. If you don't, the receiver's going to get the ball, and he's going to be going downfield. He's going to get you 40, 50 yards. You see that a lot in high school football, is if you don't get it high up enough, the guy gets the ball, and it's a touchdown most of the time. So there's a lot of strategy
all
that goes behind
punting.
Hang
time, basically.
Hang time, yeah.
Yeah.
2 years, we're going to see Pat McAfee joining in on broadcasts like Jay Feely is now.
His analysis. He's in the WWE now.
I actually
he signed.
This is
for the brand. That's his thing.
This is a sports like a sports fan hot take, but I can't stand Pat McAfee.
Really?
I don't think his
is that just a Barstool Sports thing, or is that
no,
a Pat McAfee?
So a lot of it there is the Barstool Sports thing because I cannot stand Barstool Sports.
Okay.
And there,
I don't understand that.
Barstool is extremely problematic. I'm going to get on my soapbox here. Like, Barstool is essentially upholding toxic masculinity, and a lot of the stuff that they say is really, really terrible, especially towards women. So keep that in mind. But I also think his analysis is not that great. I think a lot of his analysis is just sort of lowbrow memes rather than sort of complicated analysis that then is... I just don't find it funny, which is part of it. Also, he has so much vocal fry.
Yeah, and the Barstool Presidente or whatever, Dave Portnoy, I guess he got kicked out of Media Day. He wasn't supposed to be there.
Yeah, and then he tried
and
to
he
get...
also tried to get into the Super Bowl.
Separate from Barstool, since Pat McAfee has his own thing now, I just think that he does not try to be your source of analysis. He knows that he's a comedic figure.
Yeah.
He does all of these things with punts. Like, it's a punt. Nobody really cares about the punt. He's making the punt fun. I think that's cool. I like his videos where he yells into the microphone for the brand. I think he's funny. I don't really have a problem
with
him.
Yeah, I'm not trying to tell you that Pat McAfee's... like, that is definitely... it's 100% my opinion. And it's just not the sort of stuff that I necessarily look for. But I do like that we're moving towards a system where a lot of sports analysis now is more like has cultural references and is sort of built more around humor and like sort of the memification of sports broadcasting in a way. Yeah. So we're about out of time. I'm going to play a song to send us out. We'll see. We'll be back in 2 weeks. This will be our regular slot. If you want to hear our GM Owen's show, he's going to be on next week at 2 to 3. But if not, we'll be back in 2 weeks for more JumboCast Radio. Do we have any broadcasts this weekend?
We do, actually. So the game we were talking about against Trinity, it's Sunday, 1 o'clock?
Sunday at 2.
Sunday at 2
And you
o'clock.
Can find that on JumboCast on YouTube. Follow us on social media. Just search JumboCast or them.
Yeah, I'll be doing play-by-play. So
yeah, so tune into that. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. In the meantime, here's a song that we didn't get to hear at the Super Bowl.
Beyond the attack, with your wings on the wind.